Hi, I'm Julie Almacher. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, the extended podcast version of my conversation with Rachel Barton Pine about her new recording Bel Canto, which means beautiful singing. Well, Rachel, let's just start right at the very beginning. The works on your new recording, Bel Canto Paganini, these are works that you have lived with for a very long time, since you were, what, 6 years old?
Well, I first started listening to the Caprices when I was six with an LP of Itzhak Perlman that my mom had bought for me. It was my bedtime bribe on nights when I really didn't want to settle down and go to sleep. My mom would say, if you'll just be a good girl and close your eyes, I'll put on your Paganini record. So I just, you know, grew up hearing all of these amazing pieces and just imagining, you know, what you could do on the violin and wanting to practice and be able to do that myself one day. And, you know, by the time I was 10, I got my first Paganini Caprice assigned by my teachers and just started learning one at a time till I'd learned them all.
Well, then you also went on to win the Paganini Caprice Prize when you were just a teenager, right?
Yeah, that was for number 5, the infamous Bouncing Bow Caprice. That was sort of my signature trick, I guess you could say.
Oh, really? What is it about that caprice that resonates with you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because number 5 is one of the most popular caprices of electric guitarists. There's even a famous scene in the 80s movie Crossroads where Steve Vai plays the devil, and then this guitar prodigy, this teenager who's the kid from the Karate Kid, you know, he goes down to battle it out for his teacher's soul, and the piece that the kid can play that the devil can't is Caprice number 5. You can look on YouTube. It's a very fun scene. But in any case, it seems like a perpetual motion, and that, you know, just being able to play all those notes really fast with the left hand is the big challenge. But in fact, that's the least of the struggles of that piece. It's all about the bow stroke, which is 3 down bows followed by an up bow over and over again, a particular kind of ricochet. Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of violinists will perform it without the original bowing, which seems a bit odd. You know, if you aren't going to do the bowing, why not just play a different caprice? So that caprice is all about the bowing. And actually, so many of the caprices have unusual bowings. You know, the backwards bow stroke in number 11. And the triple stops on down bows and up bows. You know, the list goes on. And so I actually used a transitional bow for this recording, which is what you might call an early modern style of bow. It's Pernambuco wood, which is what our bows are made out of today, and it's curved inwards, you know, as opposed to the old Baroque bows, which are curved outwards. But it's lighter and springier, and just a little more clear than the modern bows, which are, you know, heftier and have more bombast. And so that really allowed me to not only have a little bit easier time with some of these bow strokes. Not that they're easy, but you know, it just made everything pop a little more. But it also gave this the tone quality. You know, it just a more of a facility and a sweetness and delicacy at times that, you know, more closely matched my conception, which is, you know, sort of paying homage to the fact that Paganini was a contemporary of the great bel canto opera composers like Rossini and Verdi and Donizetti and Bellini. And so often you hear the caprices played with a later romantic, more muscular, fiery type of sound. And while there's certainly intensity, you know, Paganini comes from an earlier era, and I wanted to make sure to capture more of that flavor in my interpretations.
Now, you just brought up some of those operatic legends from his time. Bellini, Donizetti, Verdi, Rossini, they all admired Paganini. Why?
Yeah, well, I love the quote from Rossini that if Paganini were to write opera, he would put the rest of us out of business. Because, you know, we think of Paganini, you know, for his virtuosic tricks, you know, being a like an Olympic figure skater that goes out and nails a bunch of triple jumps. But that's really not the totality of who he was as an artist. All those women would not have been swooning at his concerts just because of fast flying fingers. You know, it was the way that he touched their hearts. And clearly, Rossini and his contemporaries admired Paganini as a composer of melody, you know, as a true artist and musician. And so, you know, in fact, he dedicates the Caprices to all the artists. And I think he's really making a statement that, you know, he intends for this music to be about color and character and melody and harmony and not just the technical tricks. So that's really what I, you know, tried to do, you know, to have all of the fast notes be not the end point, but the beginning. And then it's a question of what do you do with the notes?
Well, and I think you really emphasize that with the title of the recording itself by using bel canto in the title, which means beautiful singing, because that's what he's trying to do, right? Reinforce those beautiful melodies?
Absolutely. And there are so many of them. You know, he has some, you know, some real gorgeous, you know, there's the aria of number 21, the Amoroso. Delicate melody with a drone in number 20. That's a real earworm. Of course, we'll, you know, never forget his theme of number 24, but, you know, some other lyrical pieces actually where you wouldn't expect them, like number 12, which is this sort of you know, broken double stops across two strings. It looks like one of the most etude at first blush. The bow, the entire time without respite, it's going eo, 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 eo across the two strings. Very awkward and unrewarding to practice. But it's kind of like staring at one of those paintings that's a bunch of dots. And then if you look at it for long enough, an image emerges before your eyes. And so if you can practice that caprice enough that it starts to feel more natural somehow, then it's like all of these beautiful melodies emerge and it really has a special atmosphere. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that was so fun in preparing these.
Now, we should probably clarify that bel canto is also a style of opera writing, which Bellini and Donizetti were so well known for. And you actually worked with a bel canto singing coach as you prepared for this recording, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, that was really important to understand certain elements of timing, you know, which really don't belong to any particular school of interpretation as far as, you know, violin traditions, but really do come from that vocal world, and particularly in pieces like a couple of the extra tracks, you know, the Nel cor più non mi sento variations, which is an actual Piazzolla aria that Paganini made variations on. Sure, I was shaping the aria properly, and then the duet for one, you know, which could have lyrics to it and would sound like it had been written for the human voice. Those pieces, you know, are so firmly within that particular musical style of the early 1800s and the Italian opera world.
Now, the first caprice that you learned was actually the last one, wasn't it, number 24?
That's right. I plunged right in the deep end.
Yeah, what was most exciting about that when you were learning that first piece, when this had been something you had sort of been aspiring to your whole life?
Yeah, so when I was 10 years old and first started practicing number 24, you know, of course, I, you know, understood very well by that age, you know, the weight of tradition, you know, that this was a piece that was sort of set the bar for violinists, and here I was, you know, making my first attempts at it, and, you know, having, you know, knowing of the great renditions of so many famous violinists who had preceded me, and but it was also just so much fun to play, because unlike all the other caprices that are, you know, sort of focus on one or two techniques as their main emphases, you know, number 24, each variation is a different challenge. And so it's a little flying bows, and then it's a little, you know, octaves, and then it's some tenths, and then it's some big, you know, runs up and down the fingerboard, and then it's some pizzicatos, and, you know, so each one had a different challenge, and it was just super fun to embark upon all of them and then, you know, try to make something musically coherent out of the whole. It was just so super exciting.
So what is the story that these pieces tell about the violin and its composer? I know that you really have a strong feeling that they should be heard in their entirety. Tell me about that story that we experience.
Well, I think it's an amazing journey to listen either live or on album to the entirety of the cycle, to just see the incredible variety of what the violin is capable of. I think also, you know, the onus is on the interpreter to make sure that each individual caprice can stand on its own 2 feet in isolation, and that each one has something unique and specific to say. And so, you know, you're sort of interpreting on two levels, and that's true for any cycle. You know, this is my 35th record, one of my earliest albums, the Handel Violin Sonatas. You know, that was also, you can't just play each piece like good Handel. You have to see, well, how is the one in A major different from the one in D major, and really define them, you know, much more specifically, so that each one, you know, so that you don't feel like you're hearing more of the same. And that's the same thing for, you know, for the caprices. You can actually, you know, start to feel like, oh, here's one more fast aggressive piece, here's another fast aggressive piece, if you, you know, play them with a more bombastic virtuoso flair. They certainly have moments of that, but I think there's so much more range. For example, right away in, you know, Caprice number 2, Paganini creates a very mysterious atmosphere. And, you know, it's really captivating when you go for that kind of approach, which is not about, oh, look, I'm playing these impressive notes really well. But it's more like, okay, what's the color of the instrument? What's Paganini saying here?
Well, speaking of the color of the instrument, your instrument that you play comes from his era. How does that impact the sound or the interpretation of these caprices, or does it?
Yeah, actually, I'm very, very lucky to play an instrument made by the same maker in the very same year as Paganini's famous violin. His violin is nicknamed the Canon because of its the particular, you know, resonance and power of its voice. And my violin, also coming from Guarnieri del Gesù in 1742, you know, has that richness and that burnished tone, as it's often described, though it can certainly be light and playful when it needs to be, like in Caprices 17 and 19, for example. So it just has, you know, all the range of possibilities, and, you know, knowing that this is the same type of voice that Paganini was working with. He, of course, used gut strings. I use the modern metal strings because I figure, you know, a little bit fewer problems if I do that. But I did use, you know, the transitional bow and the Del Gesù, and so I feel like I can explore what Paganini's intentions might have been.
Now, I know you've had the chance to perform this set of pieces around the world, and there's one performance in particular that's been very memorable for you, and that's the one that you did in Washington, D.C. Would you share that story?
Yeah, I had the incredible opportunity to perform the caprices. It was actually an unusual dual concert. I played the first 12 at the Phillips Collection, and then I went across town and played the rest of it at the National Gallery, and so it was sort of a co-presenting type of scenario that the two venues had organized between themselves. But the first half in the Phillips Collection was right next to the Delacroix portrait of Paganini, which is one of the most famous images of that artist, you know, captured during his lifetime. And so that was just an incredible honor. I was surprised by how small the painting was. I was expecting something as larger than life as Paganini himself, and in fact, it's a, you know, more modest in terms of its dimensions, but, you know, it definitely captures, you know, the feel of who he was as an artist there in the image. And it was particularly inspiring to play his music on that occasion.
Well, let's talk about his image a little bit. I mean, he was really an astonishing figure on many counts. I mean, his physical appearance alone, he dressed in black, he had long black hair, he was very thin, kind of gangly. So he really looked like what we might call a modern rock star. And then he lived that lifestyle, too. And I got to thinking about you and your involvement with Earth and Grave, your metal band, and how you are always looking for ways to kind of bridge that gap between classical music and especially heavy metal and rock music. And I wondered if Paganini is helping to do that for you.
Well, you know, some of the largest constituency of customers for any given album of the Paganini Caprices are electric guitarists, because from Yngwie Malmsteen to, you know, Van Halen and all those guys, you know, they say if you practice the Caprices, you can get better on your instrument, which is absolutely true. But, you know, I feel like the aesthetic of the modern, you know, loud rock music, particularly heavy metal, you know, shredding and just this nonstop intensity is actually quite different from the aesthetic of Paganini's era in the early 1800s, 200 years ago, where you had, you know, moments of great flourishes and intensity and even bombast, but that was tempered with, you know, tasteful, more subtleties. And so it's definitely, I definitely don't take a rock and roll approach to this repertoire in totality. You know, I leave those intense moments to, you know, be contrasts to some of the other things that are going on. And I think Paganini was a complex character. He certainly had the groupies and the gambling and all of, you know, the supposed selling of his soul. Though I always question, why do we have to think that good things come from below? Why not from above? You know, why would people think his impressive technique was, you know, a gift from the dark side and not the light? But in any case, what's really fascinating is, you know, the caricature, the persona has remained with us because that's, of course, the most captivating thing. But if you read accounts of Paganini from closer to his life, books about famous violinists of the day from, let's say, the mid-1800s, for example, you get a more nuanced portrait. And, you know, Paganini was a devoted single father, for example, to his young son. There's an anecdote that I absolutely love, which doesn't fit with our current image of Paganini at all, but this book was talking about him as a generous colleague and, you know, and basically a nice guy. And there's a beautiful story where he gets into town to play that concert that night. And as he's, you know, making his way to the concert hall, he sees a young boy standing out on the sidewalk, essentially busking, you know, playing his instrument in a rather poor manner, a mediocre style. And his instrument case is open, and he's, you know, obviously trying to help his family by getting a few coins. And Paganini stops the carriage, gets out, takes the violin from the boy's hand, and proceeds to play for an hour. Of course, he attracts a huge crowd, and the violin case is overflowing with money. He hands the violin back to the boy and continues on his way. And apparently those spontaneous acts of generosity were just as much a part of Paganini's character as his seductions and all the rest.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. That is very cool to get to hear the other side of Paganini. I also want to be sure to ask you about the piece that you wrote, which are basically your theme and variations. Is it on something that you learned from Paganini? What is the introduction and theme and variations on God Defend New Zealand, which was inspired by one of your tours there?
Yeah, so I visited New Zealand in 2000, and I was, you know, really struck by the gorgeous landscape and the cute kiwi birds and the friendly citizens, and I really wanted to, you know, do something in homage to that country. But, you know, Paganini, for example, had written variations on God Save the Queen. But New Zealand didn't exist as a country when Paganini and some of those virtuosos from back then were writing all of their pieces. So I thought, well, somebody needs to do this. And so I created my own variations on the beautiful national anthem of New Zealand. And, you know, a lot of what I came up with, of course, was, you know, very definitely inspired by or borrowed from Paganini and Ernst and Vietam and all those guys. But I did come up with one little thing that I hadn't seen done before. Paganini, of course, likes to do pizzicato, plucking the string not with his picking finger, as you might say, not with the right hand, the bow hand, but he'll do it with the fingering hand, All these pull-offs, as we would say in the guitar world, giving the music this special pop. And he does that in one of the variations of the 24th Caprice, but he also has, this incredible, extremely difficult thing where he'll pluck an accompaniment with his left hand and then bow a melody with his right hand simultaneously. And of course, one finger has to stop the note that's going to be plucked, a second left hand finger has to pluck the note, and then a third left hand finger has to stop the pitch that's being bowed. So it's just like, patting your head and rubbing your stomach times 100. It's really, an excessive number of practice hours to try to do something like that, though it's totally worth it. But Paganini would typically bow the melody and pluck the accompaniment. For a generation later, an Austrian violinist named Heinrich Wilhelm Ernst, who was considered to be Paganini's successor because he tried to do stuff that was even more difficult than what Paganini had done. Ernst wrote a famous set of virtuoso variations on the old Irish air, The Last Rose of Summer. And one of those variations involves plucking out the melody with the left hand while bowing arpeggios. So essentially now the left hand has the tune and the bow is doing the accompaniment. So I decided to do neither of those things. In one of my variations, I actually have both the pizzicato and the bow play the melody in canon, which, as I said, I haven't seen done before. Adding a little something to the violin repertoire of tricks. And what's fun is that when people hear it, when Kiwis, as they call New Zealanders, hear me play that, sometimes they'll say, oh, it's like the North and South Islands, or, oh, it's like the British and Maori people. But, I love that different people hear different things when they listen to that variation. But for me, it was just plucking and bowing and not anything more meaningful than that, but certainly fun.
Now, didn't your husband, Greg, offer some suggestions about that piece as well?
Exactly. I totally blame him because he was like, hey, what if you do this? And then I said, oh, that's not possible. And then I tried it and it actually was. So, yeah, Greg is a great impetus for encouraging me to be creative.
And he also kind of inspired you to really take learning all the caprices seriously too, didn't he?
Totally. So I met Greg when I was 20 years old, actually. So we've been together now for half my life, and he's been touring around with me since long before we were married. So it's been a wonderful partnership. And early on, when we were first hanging out, I told him that I had always dreamed of following in the footsteps of, Gidon Kremer and Ruggiero Ricci and the mere handful of violinists who have ever performed all 24 caprices in a single concert. And I didn't know whether I was capable of it, but I wanted to try. But my schedule would, I would have to take a sabbatical or something like that to try to get in shape and do that. And Greg said, hey, you don't have to take a sabbatical. Just start practicing one and then add another and see how it goes. And he sort of urged me on and to do it till the point where I decided to take the plunge. And it was really interesting to build up your stamina. I guess it's like training for the marathon or something. That my first challenge was I wanted to perform the last 12. Paganini actually grouped the pieces as part 1, 2, and 3, 6 plus 6 plus 12, not 8 plus 8 plus 8, as you might imagine mathematically, which I think makes sense when you know the caprices in terms of the effort that they take. So the last 12 being essentially one-third of the job, I decided to go for that, and I was really almost cross-eyed by the time I would get through, 10 or 11 of them and could barely make my way to the end. And I thought, how can I ever, go back and add the other 12? But I got there eventually, and it was really fun to be in such good shape. But, after I had done it and as I had succeeded in overcoming that challenge, then it really transformed my relationship with the caprices, because I thought, okay, I have nothing left to prove. I can play all those notes and get through it and, have them all simultaneously prepared and in tune and fast and all of that. So then what's the point at this point? And the point is, of course, to try to create a lot of variety with them and try to say something about each one and try to, take the audience on a journey through the tone colors and expressive range of which the violin is capable. And actually, these days, when I play all 24, my favorite performances are those when the audience members don't even say anything about my technique, but instead talk about all of the music that they just heard. And that means that I actually gave a successful performance because, you know, in the end, it shouldn't just be about flying fingers.
Paganini dedicated these caprices to all the artists, and you in turn now have dedicated this recording to all the listeners. Why is that?
Well, going back to the why of Paganini, of course we can only conjecture since we can't ask him, but I really think this is very revealing because, you know, we think of this as a violinistic tour de force, but yet he didn't say to all the violinists, he said to all the artists, and I think he was making a statement about the fact that this was music, not just etudes, not just virtuosity, but that he's trying to do something more. And when you look at his harmonies, you know, he's so much more adventurous than a lot of his more conventional repertoire that he wrote, you know, for public performance to appeal to the, you know, to popular taste. He rarely performed these caprices, certainly never performed them as a cycle. So I think he was just being more compositionally experimental and wanted, you know, to make sure that people understood that that was where he was coming from. And so Paganini just, you know, leaving it not to one special friend, or the fact that he kind of left this to the world, this remarkable collection. And so, you know, since there was no recording technology in Paganini's day, the onus is on us to share this with the world. And so that was my motivation for dedicating it to all the listeners, to have that, you know, that same, you know, generosity of spirit that Paganini demonstrated, and to try to channel something of that.
Well, thank you, Rachel, for your adventurous spirit and all the great music that you bring us.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. And I'm just so thrilled to be able to share this album, because it's something that I've been working towards for most of my life.
And that's the extended podcast version of New Classical Tracks here on American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julia Macher.